Welcome back to the XCast. As ever, the truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for this, which is our episode covering the 19th episode of the third season of the X-Files, which is Hell Money. And joining me to discuss this episode is none other than podcaster, blogger, author, Darren Mooney. Hi, Darren.
Hey, Carl. How are things?
Things are pretty good, except I've been trying to come up with wordplay on the words Hell Mooney all week, and I've got nowhere. But other than that, I'm good, yeah.
Don't worry. Other than that, I'm sure you're piping hot. It's, you know, there's a lot cooking here in this episode, you know? I mean, we're just getting all fired up here.
Well, how are you anyway? Because this is the first time we've been paired up since, I think it was Nothing Lasts Forever, wasn't it? Season 11. So it's almost like we're the go-to guys for, like, organ harvesting episodes, isn't it?
I like that we have a niche. It's like, oh, don't worry, Carl and Darren will handle that one. They'll get to the heart of the matter, if you will. It's good. How are you? How are things?
Pretty good. I've been doing some deep cuts on the third season. I did, I did The List, Revelations.
Like, You think of the third season, you say deep cuts. When your deep cuts are like The List and Hell Money, like, it's a pretty good season.
I think so too. I really do. So, yeah, let's crack on, I suppose. Hell Money, 19th episode of the season, like I said. Originally aired on March 29th, 1996 in the United States. And it just makes me feel incredibly old because this is one of the very first episodes I remember actually sitting down to watch, you know, in 1996. Wow. Long time ago. Anyway, this episode was written by Jeffrey, I'm going to say Vlaming. I'm not sure, Darren, if you know the exact pronunciation.
I don't indeed. He's the gentleman who is also behind Too Shy.
Yes, that's right.
Who I believe also worked on Hannibal with Brian Fuller as well.
That's right. He was an executive producer on that, I think. Yeah. And this episode was directed by Tucker Gates, one of only two I believe he directed, the other being Elmundo Gera, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so we picked the winner.
We certainly did. And this is the episode, of course. It's set in San Francisco. It sees Mulder and Scully, aided by a local detective, uncover a sinister organ lottery. I'm not sure if there are any such things as a non-sinister organ lottery, but there we go.
It's a very pleasant family-run organization, very cheerful.
So, I mean, I don't know, just to kick us off, I suppose, I mean, I quite like this one, actually. I don't think many people do. I'm going to give it, it's somewhere between like a 7 and a 7.5 out of 10 for me. What about yourself, Darren? I know you like this one.
This is a 9. This is a hard 9. The only thing that keeps it off the 10 is, and again, I say this loving Mark Snow and acknowledging that it's very difficult to score 26 episodes of 44-minute television in a year, but Mark Snow's sort of ominous ethnic chimes of doom, which sound a little bit, they tend to pop up in these episodes around subcultures. And I think Tellico has some very obvious examples. Elmundo Giro has quite a few as well. I think even Tezo dos Bichos, which led us into this one, has that sort of Mark Snow ominous ethnic sounds of doom going on as well. And there are points in the episode where it feels a bit much here. I can totally see some of the complaints about the episode in terms of, say, story structure, in terms of its exploration of an ethnic subculture. But I absolutely love it. I adore it. It's one of those episodes that is so weird and bizarre that it's almost hard to classify in terms of an X-File, because it's not really an X-File. And I mean that in terms of it's not a case with a supernatural element, but it's also not an episode where Mulder and Scully actively do that much in terms of the plot. They just sort of, they bear witness to what's happening, and they sort of act confused and manage to piece together everything that's happening, but after the fact. So all they do is really just recognize that something has gone horribly wrong in this community and just sort of bear witness to that. And I realize that's a source of complaint, and I understand that some people have like legitimate gripes with the episode for that reason, because, you know, that's not why you tune into the X-Files, but I appreciate it. I thought it was doing something clever. I thought it was doing something different. Obviously not as different as Jose Chung's From Outer Space, to give an example of what's coming up next week, but something that was a little outside the show's comfort zone, outside of what I expect from an X-File. And so it's refreshing and it's interesting. And at the same time, it speaks to me about what the X-Files is about. It kind of hits on the big themes, the big ideas that I associate with the show, but in a way that's novel, which is, like, for a show that produces, what are we on now, 230 episodes-ish?
Something towards that end anyway, yeah.
Like, to have an episode that, like, is at once the perfect prototypical X-Files in terms of theme and in terms of ideas and in terms of core concepts, and And then to also be like so atypical in X-File in terms of structure, in terms of storytelling, it's just, it's fascinating to me, and I absolutely adore it.
I think the thing I enjoy about it is the way it establishes and sustains very effectively, I think, you know, this mood and tone that, you know, overall it's very impressive, I think. There's lots there that you've touched on that I want to come on to, such as Snow's score.
Definitely. Jumped ahead.
No, no, not at all. Darren, I know you're a big, I don't know, aficionado of the IMDb. I'm not sure if that's putting it exactly right, but you pay a lot of attention to it. I know you do an IMDb-focused podcast, don't you, the 250?
We do indeed, yeah.
I don't know if you've had a quick peek at how this one scores on there.
I couldn't bring myself to do it, Carl.
Well, they're not quite as infused about it as you.
Yes, I suspected not. Are we talking 6.8?
No, a little higher. This was given 7.2 out of 10. That's from about 2,200 ratings at the time of recording, which is not too bad, except that it puts it 23rd out of 24 for the third season.
The Blessing Way. I mean, like, I know I was mean towards The Blessing Way, but I mean, come on, people. Like, I admire what The Blessing Way does, but there is no way that it is worse than this episode.
I mean, where would I put this? I don't know. I'd certainly put it a bit higher. Yeah, I mean, we've talked a little bit, or you talked a little bit there about why the fans may have problems with this one. I mean, do you think there's anything else there? I just wonder. Is it the pacing? Or is it, what is it?
I don't know. I mean, well, I think that it is. It is very much, it's not a typical X-File, but I also think that it's an episode that's not, where Mulder and Scully don't really contribute much to the plot in terms of storytelling. So if you're watching, like, invested in Mulder and Scully, it's not a very satisfying episode, because they spend the entire episode a step or two behind what's actually happening and make absolutely no difference in terms of the plot. It's Chow who actually makes the difference in terms of saving the life at the climax of the episode. But even then, it's him who shoots the hard-faced man. And even when Mulder and Scully do manage to arrest the hard-faced man and bring him into custody, he goes free at the end because there's nothing they can do. And it's an episode that sort of underscores it. It almost makes Mulder and Scully seem useless, which I can understand being a point of frustration. You're watching a show called The X-Files about these two guys called Mulder and Scully. Like, you're meant to be watching them do stuff. So spending 44 minutes watching them sort of play catch-up with something that's happening that doesn't involve them, doesn't involve the core premise of the show, really. I can understand why there's a voice of frustration there. I can also, being entirely honest, completely understand the people who are wary of the episode because of its portrayal of the Chinese community in America. And this is something that's very common in the early episodes, in the early season of The X-Files. I was on another X-Files podcast with the guys up in Vancouver, not another X-Files podcast. And we were sort of discussing about how one of the interesting and more subtle shifts in the show is how the early seasons tend to focus on subcultures. So, for example, you think of episodes like Fresh Bones in the second season with the Haitian refugees. You think of episodes like Tesoros dos Bichos, which is about, you know, sort of smuggling this artifact from Central America. You have obviously this episode about the Chinese community. You've got Teleco in the fourth season about this about basically this African sort of monster that's basically Tombs but with wind chimes. You have obviously the fourth season, El Mundo Giro, the one with the Mexican immigrants, which is sort of structured like a soap opera. And it's all very, it can be quite tactless at times. And like, you think of stuff and like, if you updated that and did that today, you'd end up with something like Babylon, which is quite rightly derided as something that is very tone deaf and something that's out of touch with the what we expect from modern television. And also, to be honest, would have been out of touch if it aired in the 90s as well. And I understand those complaints when it comes to looking at something like Hell Money. By the way, the interesting thing is that when the show moved to Los Angeles, it stopped using, well, it used race a lot less as a divider and more focused on class. So think of episodes like Thief, which focuses on a white man from Appalachia who can't read, or think about Drive with Crump, who is sort of lower working class, or various other episodes like that, like Salvage or Shorekill in the eighth season, which focus on working class sort of environments more than the show had done during its time in Vancouver. And it's kind of an interesting sort of divide there between the two halves of the show in terms of how they explore cultures that they deem other or alien. And I am entirely sympathetic to that. It is a little weird and it is a little uncomfortable to have a show like starring two white protagonists and written by a primarily white and male writing realm, basically dealing with sort of these strange foreign cultures in a way that can be exploitative and sometimes insensitive. I'd being honest, I absolutely hate Tessa Dos Bichos. I absolutely hate El Mundo Giro. I really dislike Teleco. But I do think that there is, while acknowledging that there is a certain amount of insensitivity in episodes like this, I mentioned Mark Snow's score, but even Fresh Bones, in terms of like the cliche of, oh my God, they're practicing voodoo. They're from Haiti and they practice voodoo. And it's all, you know, it's this whole big book of cliches about what people think about when they think about subcultures. I think there's something interesting in the way in which The X-Files deals with the idea of like the other, or of like social groups and organizations. Because it's not just, it's not an ethnic divide in general. The X-Files is primarily fascinated with how different we are from one another and how hard it is for us to understand and relate to other people. And it, like, Jose Chung's From Outer Space is coming, you know, on next on the show, and they have that wonderful line where it's like, you know, we may not be alone in the universe, but most of us are alone here on Earth. And like the show reinforces that in a number of different ways. But like what it does in Hell Money, which it does really well and is fair and also very complicated, is the idea that there are subcultures and groups that people will not always understand because they are outsiders to those groups. We will not always understand how social groups function and how dynamics work because by our nature, we sometimes exist from other groups. And that's not to excuse xenophobia or racism or anything like that, but it's more to accept that, you know, in a multicultural society, part of multiculturalism is accepting that there are differences between various groups and various societies and various subcultures and how they organize themselves. And there are limits to how much outsiders can understand the experiences of people who live within those communities. And I really think that Hell Money captures that brilliantly. Like, for example, there's the really great conversation with Chow where he talks about how he might look Chinese. As far as Mulder and Scully are concerned, he looks Chinese. Like, he may as well be like one of the people they're interviewing on the street. But when the members of the community look at him, they see him as ABC, American-born Chinese. He's just as white as Mulder and Scully are, which is a level of complexity that you rarely see shows that deal with, like, you know, with ethnic subcultures and about relationships that like, exist within these groups. And it's kind of interesting because you're seeing this now in popular culture in like discussions of the African American experience and stuff like that, and how it's more complicated than simply existing as one homogenous group. But it's kind of like, I don't think Hell Money is as sophisticated as something like, say, Atlanta, or something as Luke Cage, because obviously it's written from a perspective of an outsider. But I do think that there's an interesting level of nuance to the episode, and how the episode presents its sort of exploration of this subculture that kind of makes it very appealing to me. That makes it kind of that kind of stokes my interest.
Yeah, and I'm keen to dig more into this because the issue of racial insensitivity forms quite a bit of the like mailbag discussion we have, which we'll go through.
And all
of
that's fair. All of that is very fair. I accept that prima facie.
Yeah. Well, I feel the episode presents kind of a mixed bag on that front, I think. And what would be good is if we can kind of dig through it as we go along, I guess. So let's talk a bit about that teaser, which begins, you know, with this bustling street scene in Chinatown, you know, leads on to a confrontation in an apartment. We see the masked figures that we'll see a few more times through the episode. And then, of course, it ends with the scene in the funeral home with the guard, where we see the man being cremated alive. And, you mentioned, like, otherness in this episode. And something I was reading a little while ago, a book written by a guy called Edward Said, Orientalism, which I'll just kind of paraphrase because it's been a while, but he talks about how, you know, we get these constructed ideas in the West of like Eastern cultures, and amongst other things, they're kind of presented as like exotic or backward or dangerous, you know? And in this teaser, I mean, you've got numerous things, you know, you've got the scary firecrackers going off at one point, you've got Snow's music very much, I think, playing up the exoticness.
Yeah.
And also in this teaser, which is interesting, you have the absence of subtitles in the dialogue, although that will change later in the episode.
It changes slightly, but you still get sequences, extended sequences without subtitles later on
you
as well.
You do. In this instance, what I think it does is it kind of amplifies the kind of foreignness that's at play, you know. Yeah. And I'm in two minds about it, because on the one hand, you know, I think you get this stereotypical presentation of this Eastern culture to kick us off. On the other, I suppose we should consider, you know, what the function of stereotypes is, which is that, you know, the reason people reach for them is they're kind of economical, and it kind of facilitates swift cognitive like investment, doesn't it? And I do feel that he's successful on that front in terms of getting us into the story. And I feel that the rest of the episode then presents more rounded characters and does a bit more, you know. But, I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I quite like the teaser a great deal because it captures a lot of the sort of thematic dynamics of the episode. I mean, you have, for example, that shot of the guard sitting down playing cards on his computer in an episode that later turns out to be this whole big metaphor about gambling and the lottery and, you know, whether or not that is the American immigrant experience or the American experience in general. You even have that wonderful shot, and it's a very, very effective closing shot of the teaser. It's one of the ones that stuck with me when I was much younger. Yeah. So it's this guy working under the guard, working at crematorium. He goes in back and, you know, obviously there's the ominous chimes of doom. but there's also, you know, there's the three guys wearing the Chinese opera masks, I think they are, which are another sort of, you're right, and it's an ethnic stereotype. If you want to present a sort of a Chinese character's ominous, you put them wearing these masks. Terry Gilliam, I think, sort of used them as an inspiration in Brazil. But he notices the cremation machine is on, and he goes over to have a look, and he peers in, and you get this wonderful shot, and it kind of sets up another recurring visual motif throughout the episode, which is this act of looking and peering. You get that wonderful close-up shot of his eye staring through the hole, and later on, obviously, you find out that the character who's being burned alive has lost his eye and had it replaced, and later on, there's another incident as well where another character has their eye replaced, and this whole idea of, like, observing and watching, like, the guard looking through the peer hole into like the flames. It's very much like what the audience is doing, what the show is doing, and what Mulder and Scully are ultimately doing with regards to the culture. And you're entirely correct to say that's exploitative and that's cynical and that's maybe a little bit crass, but it's also, I think, it's an interesting way of looking in that it acknowledges the sort of voyeuristic quality of this sort of storytelling. And it acknowledges the way in which, you know, the characters are positioned as outsiders to a drama that is much more intimate, personal, but also specific to this particular context and place. Like, repeatedly throughout repeatedly there's this idea of seeing and not perceiving that runs through. I mean, there's a wonderful wonderful moment where, you know, Mulder finds the chip and Chow translates it, but Chow translates it in a way that is literal rather than figurative. He gives the literal meaning of the word on the chip, and Mulder can't understand that, even though it's English, because that's not what the symbol actually means, even though it's a word in the English language that it transposes to. So you have this element of a lack of cultural understanding and context, which sort of runs through the episode, which I think it captures very well. And I actually admire the lack of stereotypes. I think it's amazing to have an episode of primetime television in the 90s that featured this much unsubtitled foreign dialogue, or dialogue that was in a language that wasn't English. Because I think it does an excellent job of reinforcing that the audience, again, just like Mulder and Scully, and just like the people writing the show, are outsiders peering in. And it reminds us, it puts a distance between us and what's happening in a way that means we never feel entirely comfortable with it, which I think is a double-edged sword, because that plays into, obviously, you're right about stereotypes, but appropriation, exploitation, and otherness. But it also reminds us that this isn't ours. This isn't something, we aren't creating this for, you know, we aren't creating this culture for our entertainment or that sort of thing. It's like, you know, the characters don't speak English because they're serving us as a white audience, which I think is interesting. And you're right that it's complicated and it's sort of nuanced. And I don't think it entirely works, but I think it works well enough that I can sort of give it a pass on that.
Yeah, well, I feel that the lack of subtitles later in the lottery scenes works tremendously well, actually. And I think part of it is because the visual storytelling's so strong, you know, it's real clarity to those scenes. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. I mean, when Mulder and Scully turn up, I know you've touched on this already, but what I like about their role in this episode is that I feel it's kind of appropriate that in a story which is about marginalised people, you know, those marginalized people are given the chance to sort of occupy center stage a bit more. And this week, you know, on this show, Mulder and Scully are a little bit more peripheral. And I just like that.
Can we just focus on just that? Like, we're jumping after the credits here. So we can say, like, this is an episode of 90s television that features guest performances from B.D. Wong, Lucy Liu, and James Hong. Like, this is an A-list cast of television. If you have to take the focus off Mulder and Scully, if you have to take off David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, these are three actors you can trust to do that with. And I think they're all very good. I think that Lucy Liu is probably, at this stage, she's not given enough as Kim, but she's quite good. But I think B.D. Wong is fantastic. And James Hong is amazing, but he always is. So I think that you do have a base with this when you're taking the focus off Mulder and Scully, in that you have a cast of guest characters who are one-shot characters who will never appear again, but who are enough to hold the interest over the course of the episode, at least for me.
Oh, definitely. And the first one we meet is Glenn Chow, played by BD Wong. And yeah, I feel his performance is very convincing and very dynamic, actually. And I guess I kind of associate him from Jurassic Park primarily. I mean, what else have you seen him in, Darren?
I mean, lots of things. I mean, he was recently Hugo Strange in Gotham, for example. He was on Law and Order for ages. He's just one of those great actors who, when he pops up, he popped up one of my favorite performances from Wong, and it's a tiny performance, but he's so good in it. He was in, have you seen Focus?
Is that the Will Smith?
That's the Margot Will Smith,
Robbie.
Margot Robbie one.
Yes.
He has this sort of, he plays this Mark, and it's probably the best scene in the film. He's this guy who loves to gamble. And he has this sort of gambling back and forth with Will Smith. And Margot Robbie doesn't know whether this is a con or whether or not this is Will Smith sort of like his gambling addiction playing up. And you have sort of BD Wong being this sort of third party who's kind of oblivious to the dynamic between them, but still like basically cramming pieces of scenery into his mouth. It's amazing. It's one scene that, like, I like Focus more than most people because it's a movie that, ironically enough, given its title, lacks focus. But when you get those scenes, like those fast sort of patter conversations where people are talking about things but meaning different things and talking past one another, and BD Wong is just there having the time of his life, it's hard not to get swept up in it.
Cool. So we meet him first. He's got some really strong moments in this episode. And shortly afterwards, we meet Mr. Sin and his daughter Kim, played by Lucy Liu, like you say. And I guess this is just a couple of years maybe before Ally McBeal, or maybe a little bit more, I'm not sure.
Before it's sort of established Lucy Liu, because she is credited as Lucy Alexi Liu as well. So this
is a
very early role for her as well. But she's very good in it.
Yeah, it's interesting that allegedly, or apparently, the dialogue between these two characters was all kind of redone in post-production.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently they spoke on set in Mandarin, and then it was redone afterwards in Cantonese.
Ah, okay. Which is an interesting, it's a nice example of attention to detail, if anything.
Definitely.
Because, I mean, there is a tendency to assume that, like, all Asian actors and all Asian dialogue is the same. And like, particularly again in the context of a 90s episode of television, I mean, our standards are much, much higher now, and they should be, but I think that in the context of a 90s episode of television, that's quite a decent level of attention to detail.
And another choice that's made, of course, is that whereas we said before, there are no subtitles in the teaser, there are subtitles, of course, aren't there, through their scenes.
Yeah.
And I think what I like is that these characters, they get a couple of scenes, you know, just on their own, quite lengthy, you know, they kind of exist in the story outside of Mulder and Scully. I felt that was nicely done, actually.
Yeah, and it is, and it's telling that it's sort of that the episode sort of warms, the episode brings us into their domestic situation, and it's you know, the subtitles as well are actually, the subtitles are very well done. They're done in yellow text as well, which implies that they're, it's not just a simple dub, it's not just a simple sort of like technical sort of like just map over C-SPAN. There's a lot of attention that went into here, and I think that it works very well. It welcomes us into the Sin family, in contrast to later on where you have the, as you pointed out, the sort of lottery scenes, which we'll probably get to in good time, where there's something more alien about them, something more hostile about them. But even the scenes with Mulder and Scully, like once Mulder and Scully come on the scene, the subtitles drop as well, generally, which is a reminder again. Part of that's just plot driven, because obviously you need Chow to be there to create an ambiguity and a space, a liminal space between what's being said and what he's translating. But it's also an interesting way of reinforcing the fact that Mulder and Scully are outsiders. But it's nice to have those scenes that do treat, you know, Sin, the Sin family, as like as characters, as like ordinary people having ordinary conversations in the same way that they would if they were, you know, if they were white, and that their problems are relatable. She is suffering from a terminal illness and he is trying to provide for her, which is the most basic, like, of character motivations, the most universal of character motivations. And even in this episode, in which there is a strong sense of otherness at play, and there is a strong sense of like a, you know, the Mulder and Scully not understanding the dynamics at play within the Chinese immigrant community, it's still something that makes it, you know, that transcends that, which is I think very worthwhile.
Yeah, and of course his personal motivation plays into those lottery scenes. And first of all, those lottery scenes look great the way they're done, you know, very smoky, very atmospheric. And the way they play out, you know, is just fascinating, you know. We get various indications through the course of them, don't we, that there's this kind of exploitation of ancient spiritual beliefs and customs going on. I like the removal of the paranormal element, I guess. I know we see some of the characters have visions of ghosts,
But on the other hand, they are quite doped up and, you know, implied to be under anesthetic.
Very much. But I like the way that the episode conveys, you know, their exploitation, I suppose.
Well, I mean, like, this is the wonderful tension within the episode, because obviously this was written, this would have been written around the time of the tragedy of the Golden Venture, which happened in June of 1993, which was a cargo ship that had been smuggling 286 illegal immigrants from China that ran aground in Queens, 10 people drowned while trying to swim to shore. And it basically opened up this whole big discussion about, like, people smuggling and the exploitation of immigrant communities by the Snakeheads, I think they were known, by Cheng Chuping, and I apologise if I mangled that pronunciation, but this sort of exploitation within the community by people who exist in the community already, like exploiting the desire to come to America and exploiting the desire to have a new beginning and a fresh start. And this is one of the things I absolutely love about the episode, unreservedly. This is the thing that gets me past all the, well, it's a little bit, you know, it is a little bit insensitive, it is a little bit, you know, there's something like a little bit exploitative about certain aspects of it. But what gets it over the line and makes it a sheer, like, unreserved classic for me is the idea of the lottery as a central metaphor within the episode, which is, and the idea of the lottery is very, very simple. It's that you put your name in, you pay an admission fee, and there's a chance you can draw. If your name gets drawn, you go up and you draw, and there's a chance that you can win all the money. You can win $2 million, which is enough to do whatever the hell you want with. It's enough to ascend to the heights. It's enough to transcend, like, your background. You could probably buy a green card. You become a legitimate citizen. You know, for the Sin family, that's enough to get her sort of on those organ transplant lists. You can accomplish anything you want to do, but there's also a chance when you reach in there that you will take out a pip that will mean that, you know, you will have to sacrifice an eye, a limb, a heart, a kidney, a liver. You'll have to give those things up and surrender them so they can be sold on by these people who are literally exploiting human bodies, which is not at all, you know, a subtle metaphor for everything from slavery to people trafficking, which is the, you know, the capitalist exploitation of the human body for financial gain by those in power. And what I really like about, like, Hell Money at its core is how it treats the American dream. And again, this is, you know, we describe it as the American dream. It's the immigrant experience around the world, but it's epitomized by the American dream, because the America is a young country. It's relatively new. It's relatively fresh. It's a country that in theory exists without a system of rigid class that exists in, say, the UK or in Europe or in the old world or even in the countries that these people have emigrated from. The idea is you come to America, you make a fresh start, you make something of yourself, you pull yourself up, you can accomplish anything, you know, if fate is with you. And the lottery is like a literalization of that concept. And I mean, it's telling that, like, when you travel the web, you see all these green card, or at least I do. I don't know what that says about what Google thinks about me as an advertising service, but you see lots of green card lottery advertisements. And it's sort of like, if you enter this lotto and you win, you get a green card, and that's your ticket to freedom. That's your ticket to ride. Because America is something that exists as this fundamental ideal of a place where you can go and you can do anything. And I love that Hell Money taps into that by making it a literal lotto and by making it a literal gamble. And it's not just a metaphor for the immigrant experience, although we think about it in those terms because the episode frames it in those terms. It's a broader metaphor, I think, and it resonates, at least to me. And again, maybe I'm talking out of my backside here and maybe listeners think I'm being crazy and I'm reading too much into it. But it also, the lottery metaphor captures for me a sense of what it's like to live in modern society, and like in a capitalist society, in a market-driven society, in a sort of a market-driven, in a society that's based around the idea of, like, liberal economic principles, which is the idea that your fortunes can rise and fall depending on your investments, upon luck, upon chance, upon being in the right place at the right time and having the right thing happen to you. Like, our entire existence is arguably a lottery. In that we are subject to forces of fate and chance that exist beyond what we, you know, beyond what we can comprehend and understand. And our choices sometimes don't always make that much of a difference in how things turn out, because we're affected by factors that are outside of our control. Our background, our race, our class, our economic status, you know, our dependency on the people around us, our family connections, that sort of stuff. And the lottery scenes in Hell Money tap into that, because they also get at the idea, and I don't want to skip ahead to the end about what it reveals about the game in there, because that reveal at the end of the episode is at once entirely logical and perhaps maybe a little predictable, but also fits very much with the metaphor of what it's doing. But there's something very, very powerful in this idea of, like, Hell Money saying, these people have come to America and they want something better for themselves, and they've taken these huge risks to get there. And like every immigrant who's come to America, whether legally or illegally, has taken a huge risk to do that. They've crossed, you know, tremendous distances, oceans. They've put themselves in mass amounts of danger, particularly people who are seeking asylum. And it's a huge gamble. It's a huge risk. And as somebody pointed out, you don't put a child in the water unless the water is safer than the land. And it just, there's something that resonates. And maybe this is because I'm Irish and we have this sort of background of emigration and we see ourselves as a nation of immigrants. But when I watch Hell Money, that really resonates with me. The idea of these families of people who have traveled halfway around the world wanting to gamble, wanting to believe that they can somehow not only survive, but thrive based on luck and chance. And I really, really love that. And the gambling sequences capture that absolutely beautifully.
Yeah, interesting. And I think that what's fascinating in some ways is that in some regards, the episode we've said is dated, not particularly well. In other ways, though, perhaps it's acquired some kind of contemporary resonances that wouldn't have been there pre the 2008 financial crash, for example. I know we're not going to spoil the ending, like we said, but the the idea of flawed capitalism, for example. I mean, as we record this, where are we? We're like in the middle of June, late June, and you know, in terms of migrants, you know, there's all sorts going on in the United States, and pretty terrible situation in the Mediterranean as well. So it's really quite heartbreaking, actually, that some of the issues at play here, if anything, are worse than they were in the 1990s, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really great quote here from Polly Cantor, who's written about the X-Files in Gilligan Unbound. It's a really great sort of look at popular culture through the prism of sort of like academic writing. And he talks about how the lottery in Hell Money is in fact one of the most striking emblems the X-Files offers of modernity. A world in which the only thing men have in common is their greed. The episode's title points to its central idea that money and the pure economic rationality it represents create a new hell for the modern man. The name refers to the kind of false money used in a Chinese ritual for appeasing the ghosts of the dead. But the larger suggestion is that all money is fake, a false goal relentlessly pursued by modern man, who thereby plunges him into a hell of his own making.
All right, so I mean, I'll tell you something else I appreciate about this episode is that, well, I mean, let's explore it a bit, actually, because I'm in two minds. There's a striking moment on the street where Mulder and Scully are talking to Chow, and he says, you know, it's hard to argue with 2,000 years of belief, but I'm more haunted by my mortgage payments.
Yes.
And I really do like that moment, because, I mean, you do get a sense here, don't you, in this episode of there's kind of a spectrum of, like, lived existence for Asian Americans, which is very positive, I think, which is good. There's a bit of nuance. On the other hand, I think all the named characters that we meet, Asian American characters that we meet, are kind of in the orbit of organized crime, you know.
Yes, that is unfortunate.
That's an issue, isn't it, I think?
That is indeed. And that's, like, in some ways prefigures the issues that you have with Babylon, where there's, like, one single female character from that ethnicity who is not a terrorist. And it's a very fair observation to make about the point, about the episode. And it is, like, Chow, for example, is rendered as complicit in the system, which is, like, which plays very well within this metaphor of, like, capitalism, because everybody is complicit in capitalism. Everybody buys into capitalism. But it doesn't work as well in the context of being a story about a minority group, where it's literally like every Chinese person that Mulder and Scully meet is complicit in this scheme and this conspiracy. And it's like, it is a little dodgy. Now, I feel like I'm writing this episode a lot of excuses, but it kind of gets back to, and we'll talk about it when we get to the end, when we get to the final scene, because I think the episode does something that's very clever, that allows me to, like, you know, while acknowledging that these issues are there and are definitely not something that I would be comfortable watching on television today, I think the episode does something relatively smart with them, in that I think that Chow being complicit is a terrible thing from the point of view of this being an episode about an ethnic minority group. But I also think it's a very clever thing in this being an episode about, like, capitalism and society in general, and how, you know, these atrocities perpetuate themselves on scales both epic and intimate.
What it feels like to me with him, though, is, I mean, when I think back to this episode, I remember, you know, his kind of dynamism, like I already said. And I wonder if it's like these old, like, 1930s Warner Brothers gangster movies or something, where, you know, they're kind of, at the time, you had the production code, which meant that they'd get their comeuppance or whatever. But what's really stayed with you is what happened through the bulk of the film. And I sort of feel that way about Chow, in that when I think back, you know, in kind of a fragmented way about Helmany, it's the early part of this episode which I remember, like when Mulder and Scully confront him.
Oh, at his desk.
At his desk, and they come on quite strong, actually. I actually find him quite unsympathetic in that instance, you know. But his riposte is really interesting. I think you might have touched on this already, but it's when he says, "You don't know what you're dealing with. To them, I'm just as white as you are," you know. And the episode is just punctuated with these great moments for him.
And there is. There's something very almost film noir about the way that Chow is presented, where he's this sort of like, he's trying to stay almost ahead of Mulder and Scully. And like, as they point out, he leaves hospital. He runs out of hospital to avoid having to explain what the hell happened to him. And there's a sense of a guy like struggling to stay afloat. And you're right that the episode doesn't do it as well as it could, in that I would absolutely love to see an episode that was told from Chow's perspective. And I feel like if they'd done this episode 2 years later in the fifth season, it probably would have been, where Mulder and Scully would have been these characters appearing at the periphery of the narrative and being as terrifying to Chow as they are, yeah. You know. But it is a shortcoming of the episode that you don't get as much of this as you should. But there is a sense almost of Chow as like the lead actor in his own sort of like 1930s film noir, where he's made a number of serious, very, very serious mistakes, and they are desperately catching up to him. And he's struggling to stay afloat, and he can't quite do it, while also trying to figure out a way to do something resembling the right thing. And, you know, spoiler alert, it all ends up being completely meaningless because the system cannot be resisted. But there's something very powerful in that. And I think Wong actually captures that very well in his performance. And I think that Wong carries a lot of the episode.
Yeah, he absolutely does. And I think the reason, of course, they confront him, which we just kind of skipped over, but we'll go back, is he had, you know, told him about the meaning of the dead frog, the dried frog earlier, hadn't he? And then when Scully does the autopsy, there's the moment where the live frog climbs out of the body, which apparently was kind of a neat effect that they did, where they built a fake torso and they put it over the actor or whatever. It's a very memorable moment, though, isn't it? That's kind of one of the very earliest X-Files kind of memories I formed, I think, is seeing that.
It is, and you can sort of, you wonder if there was some link between that and Badla. If they're like, well, we got a frog to come out of a dude. What if Badla, another episode that isn't particularly sensitive in its handling of an ethnic minority group.
No, not quite. In terms of Chow, you know, there's a scene at his apartment, isn't there, where he's confronted by the masked men. Mulder and Scully, I think, are on a stakeout at the time, staking out Mr. Sin, but they go to try and see him at a hospital, so they miss the entrance of James Hong's character to see Mr. Sin. The hard-faced man is what he's credited as, isn't he?
Yeah.
So what do you make of him? He's a very, very fascinating figure, isn't he? And again, he's this, you know, cynical exploiter of like cultural folk tales and so on, and he's trying to dissuade Sin from leaving the game. How do you see him exactly?
Well, what's interesting about James Hong's character, the hard-faced man, is he's the point at which, for me, the episode really sort of clicks into place. Yeah. And I mean, I mentioned this at the start about why I love this episode so much, in spite of, and even occasionally because of its flaws, is the fact that once he shows up, it's very clear what the episode is doing and who he's meant to be. And he's not meant to be a Chinese gangster, you know, representing this lottery. He's very clearly a stand-in for another ominous suited older gentleman who even smokes a cigarette at certain points over the course of the show, where you have this point where the episode sort of becomes almost like this ersatz X-Files conspiracy that's playing within the Chinese American community in San Francisco, with the hard-faced man as a stand-in for the cigarette-smoking man. And you can even draw obvious parallels between particular scenes in the way they're treated. That scene where he goes and visits Mr. Sin, for example, calls to mind almost the conversation between Bill Mulder and the cigarette-smoking man in Anasazi, you know, where sort of the cigarette-smoking man shows up and he's like, well, you know, you aren't actually out of this business in case you thought you were. I can still come and visit you and remind you that this is all, you know, part of your present. And no matter how uncomfortable you might feel about what you've done in the past and what you've been complicit in, you are still part of this system in which we're taking part. You know, and obviously no matter how much you might want to protect your child from the horrors of what's happened, you can't do that because you made a bad choice and you have to live with that now. And you have that sort of dynamic at play. And then you have moments later on where, like, there's, like, the final scene, and again, I'm jumping ahead here, but just to illustrate the point, the final scene between the hard-faced man and Scully is where he's in the interrogation room, he's smoking a cigarette. Which is obviously, and again, this is the show very clearly making it clear that this is basically like San Francisco Chinatown's answer to William B. Davies is in the house. And he even gets this wonderful sort of monologue. And you have this moment where he states, he has two key lines of dialogue or two key conversations in there. And the first one is when he talks about how his people believe that the ghosts of his of their fathers and their fathers before them speak to them through memory, showing us the path, right? Which is a line that the X-Files hits on repeatedly over the third season, in that the third season is very much about, and the X-Files as a whole is very much about, this idea of memory, cultural memory, about like how we hang on and how we remember horrible things that have happened, and how we sort of we sort of process them and we record them and we sort of create a record of them, and what we learn from the past and how what we learn from the past affects us in the present. But it's also a very literal line, a very literal sort of almost reference to a line from Piper Maru, which was, you know, right before this in the third season order, where Scully goes to visit Johansson. And Johansson argues that, like, conscience is nothing but the voices of the dead calling out to us from history, and guiding us and helping us to stop making the same mistakes. So it's interesting to see, like, that idea, which is very clear to, like, the, you know, the central themes of the third season, the X-Files and the X-Files as a whole, articulated in this one-shot guest character whose primary role is smoking a cigarette. More than that, though, you get this wonderful sense of symmetry, like this wonderful sense of, like, and this is one thing that I like about the third season. The third season of The X-Files is wonderfully thematically coherent from beginning to end. It almost, like, even the episodes that are standalone, like you talk about the, you know, the wall that exists between the standalones and the mythology episodes with DPO, where, you know, Scully's like, oh, I hope you don't think this is a government conspiracy. I'm always like, oh, no, not this week. But you, even within these episodes, you have, like, recurring motifs that play into, like, the mythology of the show and what the show is dealing with in the mythology episodes. So you have, for example, that moment where Scully's, like, you know, accusing the hard-faced man of, you know, what he's done. And his response to that is, look, I gave these people hope. That's what I did. Mm. I offered them a promise.
His gift.
And that was his gift to them. And later on in the third season, in Talitha Kumi, the final episode, you have that great conversation between Jeremiah Smith and the cigarette-smoking man, where, you know, the cigarette-smoking man says, who are you to give them hope? And, you know, and Jeremiah Smith responds with, well, what do you offer them? And he says, I give them happiness. In return, they give me authority. And it's very much the same dynamic. That's, you know, and the lines are similar enough that you wonder if the writers were sort of sitting there tweaking them, going, this is a nice little intentional echo we're doing. Or if Chris Carter was frantically rewriting these scripts in, like, a desperate haze, trying to get them in front of the cameras, going, oh, that's a good line, I'll just take that one. But you have this idea of, in Hell Money, you have these ideas that are core to the X-Files, which are, and you have this, like, it reminds me of Anasazi, where Bill Mulder, like, talks about how, like, Mulder's politics are his own. He's never thrown in with anybody. And you have this dynamic playing out in Chinatown, where Chow has thrown in. Chow's politics aren't his own. Sin's politics aren't his own. They are complicit in this little miniature conspiracy that's playing out in San Francisco's Chinatown, which is, in its own way, like a microscopic, intimate reflection of, like, the wider conspiracy that is perpetuated by gentlemen like the cigarette-smoking man and the well-manicured man. And this is kind of, this is almost what gives the episode kind of a pass for me when it comes to its portrayal of, like, ethnic communities and minorities and its handling of its Chinese-American characters, is that while the movie points out that this is ominous and sinister, what's happening in Chinatown, it's very much framed in the context of, and it's exactly the same as what's happening in the corridors of power. There's this idea that systems of exploitation and systems of violence and, like, systems of manipulation and control all play out at various levels. And it doesn't matter whether Mulder and Scully are investigating the cigarette-smoking man who's organizing this conspiracy to colonize the world with these aliens from, you know, outer space who are actually the original inhabitants of the planet, or if they're just investigating an organ-harvesting ring in a San Francisco Chinatown. The idea is the same logics at play. It's all about the exploitation and control. And the hard-faced man is just another expression, another facet of the same evil embodied by the cigarette-smoking man. He's greed, he's authority, he's power. He's this man who has convinced the people around him to buy into something horrendous and monstrous in order to enrich himself and to cement his own sense of power. And in spite of all his evil, he's untouchable through the systems of justice, because those systems are so fundamentally broken as to render him untouchable. It's, and I really, really like that about the episode, because you have, this idea of all this stuff that's so essential to the X-Files, this idea of family, this idea of like capitalism, this idea of buying into a corrupt political system, and you play it out in a community that is, as far as the audience is concerned, very different from them. But you see that these cycles repeat, that these patterns play out, that these, you know, with variations and with different motifs and maybe, you know, different notes hit along the way, but the rhythm is the same, the tempo is the same, and I really, really like that about Hellmoney.
Yeah, and in terms of like your comparison with Piper Maru, I'll tell you sort of the way I see that. In England, a couple of hundred years ago, there were a group of poets known as the Graveyard School, and they kind of came along. They came before the Gothic, and, you know, in terms of horror, the Gothic literature and so on is what's typically associated with early horror. But actually, the Graveyard School, they set up a lot of like the iconography of the horror genre, like crypts and skeletons and decomposing remains and so on. But they were very like spiritually minded, you know, and I think what comes through in their work is that this idea that insights into life comes about through kind of contemplating death and the dead, you know. And I think it's apparent all the way through the X-Files, actually, from the very first episode, almost in the pilot. Mulder has that moment where he has that sudden flash of intuition and, hey, it's Billy Miles we're looking for, you know, and he's in a graveyard at the time when he makes that jump. But then all sorts of other episodes, Piper Maru and Apocrypha is a strong example, even stuff like Hollywood AD, you know.
With the zombies dancing.
Exactly right, after Mulder has said...
what happens when they eat all the brains?
Exactly. They come back and they dance and they et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I like that comparison with Piper Maru, the idea that... what was the exact quote? It was about, you know, the voices of ghosts speak through...
It is, my people live with ghosts, the ghosts of our fathers and our fathers' fathers. They call to us from distant memory, showing us the path. Which I think is one of the, like, that's a ghost story. A ghost story is basically a story about how we cannot escape our past. I mean, if you want to look at it in a literary sort of like theory sort of way, most ghost stories are basically about like either a sin has been committed and people need to reconcile themselves with that, which is arguably what the X-Files is. Horrible sins have been committed and we need to reconcile ourselves with that. Or they're about like facing the consequences of past actions, like Edgar Allan Poe stories where people are literally haunted by their misdeeds.
Yeah, and I mean, we've skipped to the end, but we should just backtrack a little to that final lottery scene, I suppose. Chow confronting the people running the game and so on. And like we said, you know, kind of hinted at, you know, the rigged game, you know. And if you were so minded to do, you could entirely look at this as a metaphor for modern capitalism, couldn't you?
You could indeed. I mean, that's the beauty of it, is the idea that the game is basically rigged. There's no way to win the game. And I mean, this is the interesting thing about... And again, the X-Files is one of the things I love about the X-Files is it obviously captures the 90s in sort of on television. You know, I was going to say on film, but it was shot on film, so it does capture the 90s on film. But it captures this sort of like the spirit of the decade. And a lot of that's still with us, and a lot of that has actually been enhanced in recent years, as I think maybe the war on terror has sort of subsided and we're sort of dealing with like the aftermath. And you pointed out the financial crisis, you're entirely correct here. Because one of the interesting things that happened in the 70s, and this is like Jimmy Carter's, you know, great televised speech to the nation, is the idea that like our generation, the generation immediately before us, were the first generation in history who didn't believe that the future would be better, that you didn't believe that their children would have a better life or a better quality of life than they did. And I mean, all the studies and statistics have sort of borne that out as we get there. A lot of people these days don't believe that the future will be better, or that their children will be better off than they will. And I mean, studies suggest that class mobility is at an all-time low. It's a lot harder to move up the social ladder now. You know, all these stories you hear about the 1%, for example, and the concentration of wealth, the phenomenal concentration of wealth within a very small number of people. And I always sound like a raving sort of Marxist when I talk like this. I'm actually not. I'm a centrist in terms of Irish politics, which I think makes me a raging lefty in terms of American politics. But I am a European sort of central left kind of, you know, sort of political individual. But like one of the things it is alarming to see that concentration of wealth. And that concentration of wealth means that people can no longer move. There's no longer the option of mobility. There's no longer the sense of progress. There's no longer the sense of forward movement or momentum. There's no longer a sense of... And again, this ties into all sorts of other 90s stuff. The X-Files does very well. The end of history and the idea that, you know, we're no longer moving forward in any sort of meaningful sense as a society or as a culture. But in terms of like hell money, it illustrates that, like, as far as these people are playing the game, none of them will ever win. None of them will ever actually take home the $2 million. None of them will ever actually accomplish what they set out to do. They'll just play this game and they'll be exploited. They'll have their organs harvested and sold on to make these wealthy people even wealthier. And they'll continue to play because they believe the promise that they might actually earn these money back, that they might actually, you know, make something of themselves. They might somehow, against all odds, win. And it's interesting because the game's rigged, which means that it suggests that all the time that these people have been playing, they've never actually seen anybody win. They've just continued playing because they believe in the possibility of winning, which is something like, you know, if you were cynical, you'd say, well, that's an obvious logical loophole with the episode. I don't think it is. I think it's something that comments on, like, how much people want to believe. Like, and again, that's the X-Files line, I want to believe, but how much people want to believe, like, in the potential to get lucky or to advance or to change or to progress. That, you know, even when all the empirical evidence is saying that it's highly unlikely that, you know, you will strike gold, you'll be that one in a million, we still strive towards it and we still buy into it. And again, it ties into that whole thing that the X-Files sort of, you know, that throwing in concept, that sort of like being complicit in these systems and sort of through this complicity enabling them to continue to function. Because that's, you know, that's what Chow does. Chow covers up for the hard-faced man. And Chow sort of, he enables the hard-faced man to continue his exploitation of these people. And that's sort of like, even the silence of the immigrant community allows these people to sort of thrive and grow in the same way that, you know, again, this isn't sort of a sense of othering or a sense of like xenophobia. Like, passive complicity with the policies of various governments allows them to continue to function. It allows people to, you know, being willing to sit there and not to comment on horrible things that are happening in the world allows those things to continue. Like, being passive allows these systems to perpetuate themselves, these cycles of abuse. And the X-Files does that repeatedly as well. The X-Files is very much a call to action in some respects.
In terms of, like, the rigged game, it's almost like the eternal question, isn't it? Can you fetter capitalism? I mean, most people, I think, would at least say that unfettered capitalism is a bad thing. I suppose then you have the tension between, like, social democracy and socialism. You know, I suppose I identify more with the former, to be truthful. But and it's like, in my day-to-day life, I'm probably the most left-wing person I know, and I go online and I'm feel like I'm Nigel Farage or something. Yeah. You know? In terms of the idea of chance and luck, I'll just kind of throw something out there, because I'm not an expert on this by any means, but something I've read a little bit about over the years is the more central role that, like, coincidence and chance play in other cultures, you know, compared to Western ones.
Yeah.
And they don't really address that idea of chance and coincidence perhaps as much as they could have here, although it does figure into the episode, obviously, doesn't it?
It does. Well, I mean, like, again, there's an argument about, and again, it depends on how specific you want to read the metaphors in the episode. I mean, you could even read, if you want to be insanely precise, you could read the metaphor of the lotto being like a metaphor for the lottery itself, which is basically, you know, there are all sorts of like academic criticisms of like the idea of a lottery as a tax on the lowest rungs of society, because the people who play it are traditionally from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, because they're the people who most desperately need the money and who most desperately need like hope. So you're basically imposing, you're taking more money from them, and the odds of them winning statistically non-existent practically from an individual point of view. So it is sort of interesting in that respect, and I think you can sort of apply it literally. And I think maybe you're right when you say that, like, maybe there's something very bitter and very twisted in the idea that you have this sort of like ethnic, like this Chinese lottery, which is based on luck. But when it comes to America, as you pointed out, like, luck is something that we don't really buy in. And again, you're right that you don't really, because the American dream is based on the idea of like hard work and innate individual, like, individualism. And this is capitalism. Capitalism is based on like individual identity. The idea is that, like, you don't succeed because you got lucky. You succeed because you're brilliant. Because you earned it. Because you, like, the world was not enough to stop your unrestrained talent from like propelling you to the top of the spire. It had nothing to do with timing, nothing to do with like being in the right place at the right time, knowing the right people, filing the right documents, hitting the right deadlines, you know, being in the right place and the market being in the right place for your idea to land. No, it was all you, through sheer force of will, making it happen. And it's interesting because, and I don't want to go down too many tangents, but it is sort of interesting that you mention the difference between like Eastern and Western philosophies here, because when I think of America and I think of like American identity, I think a lot of things like manifest destiny, where there is this belief of fate and providence, to quote the ninth season two-parters, but this idea of like a predetermined God favors our enterprise written on the dollar bill, the idea that it's not luck, the idea that it's all as it's meant to be, which is interesting. And maybe that's a sly comment that the episode's sort of making with that rigged game. Like, it's like, we take this lottery, which we accept as something based on luck, and then we move it over to America, and it becomes this predetermined, we want an eye this week. It is worth noting, by the way, as an episode about capitalism, like, organ harvesting is, like, the most direct metaphor for capitalism you can have, short of slavery, in that it's quite literally transforming human bodies into capital, which is obviously itself works as a metaphor for, like, people smuggling and obviously like slave labor and stuff. But it is, in the context of this episode, it's very clearly, we are turning literal human bodies into economic resources, which is very, 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 very pointed, I think.
Well, like, one of the few humorous exchanges in the episode is when Scully says, like, do you know how much a human body goes for? And Mulder kind of like, you know, it depends on the body, isn't it?
Yeah.
we're almost at the end, all I'll say is the final image is quite a gripping one too, isn't it? It's Chow being burned alive in the kiln or whatever it is.
Chow cannot succeed in that sort of film noir way. You know, he can do this thing, he can save Mr. Sin's life, and you wonder if he actually did save Mr. Sin's life in the end. But he can make this big, grand gesture, and it accomplishes absolutely nothing. And I mean, again, this is something that The X-Files does repeatedly in its own sort of conspiracy and mythology, where you have these grand gestures that ultimately, like, often mean very little. The cigarette-smoking man can die. He can be burnt alive. You can burn the cigarette-smoking man alive, and he will still come back as the anthropomorphic personification of evil. But, you know, Chow does the right thing, finally, and his reward for it is to be burnt alive.
Okay, Darren, I think, if you're game, we'll dip into this week's mailbag.
Go for it.
And, this one was a bit of a slow burner. I had to prompt people a couple of times to get a few more thoughts in. I got the sense people weren't, you know, dying to get thoughts about Hell Money off their chest. But anyway, we did get some interesting stuff as it happens. So, the first one comes from Tony Black, so thanks for getting in touch, Tony, whoever you are.
I think I've heard the name before.
Vaguely rings a bell.
Yeah.
He says, this is always one I struggle with. I think it's visually interesting, and I've always liked the ambiguity surrounding B.D. Wong's Detective, but I often tend to find it quite plodding. Needs a revisit, though, as I don't tend to watch it often. And, like, the word plodding is an interesting one, because I'd probably frame it a bit more charitably as kind of measured or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I think it has a wonderful sense of, like, mounting dread as it's going on. Like, it's very clear that this is not going to have a happy ending. It's not propulsive. You're entirely correct, it's not propulsive. And when you look at, like, other, like, third season episodes, like Pusher, for example, Pusher is just sheer momentum from beginning to end. This is more, I don't want to say lyrical, because that sounds almost cliche. We were talking about, like, Mark Snow's score. But it has a sort of, like, an almost poetic quality to it, an almost like allegorical quality. It's almost like you're watching a sort of a metaphorical retelling of something. It's got that very sort of you're right. It's stately paced, perhaps.
Stately is a good word. Yeah. The episode is not constructed. You can sort of imagine it could have been in a way where we realise at the same time as Mulder that a game is being played. You know, we know quite early on exactly what's going on with the lottery, don't we? I think most viewers probably suspect something is amiss with the running of the game as well. So perhaps that plays into why people find it plodding or languid or whatever.
What do you mean those organized crime bosses can't be trusted to run a fair lottery? I'm offended, Carl.
Sarah Blair, let's hear from her, because she said, as a product of 90s urban legends, I've got a random fear of having my organs stolen. This episode only ever helped to fuel that little nightmare. It's not one I watch if I can help it. A few people said variations of the same thing. I skipped this one, or, you know, it's been a long time, or whatever. So, the issue of racial insensitivity came up in the mailbag. It was first raised by Clara Cook.
Yeah.
And she felt that, you know, the episode is racially insensitive. We talked about it, you know, quite a bit. Few people seem to agree with her. There was a bit of back and forth.
Yeah, it's entirely fair. I mean, like, I'm not going to stand here and say this is the most sensitive portrayal of the Chinese American community ever to make the screen. And I mean, I'm not going to stand here and say that the X-Files, you know, was always particularly culturally sensitive. I do think that it was a product of 90s television. I think that this is much better than the show at its worst. I think it probably still could have done better in the way that we've talked about, in particular its handling of, say, Chow and like, as you pointed out, having a member of the Chinese American community who is not complicit in this sort of massive organ harvesting operation.
Unless we count the lady who ran that little shop that they go to.
Being honest, the way the episode's written, I'm not entirely sure we can.
No, I mean, we kind of skip that scene, though, but it's interesting there that Chow actually uses the words exotic stuff to describe what's being sold in the shop, you know, and like we were talking about Orientalist stereotypes.
Exoticism,
that is very much.
Yeah,
yeah, very much. What you said about this being a product of its time, the 90s, was also mentioned by Amy Walker, who said, "I don't think it's the most racially insensitive thing ever. I think if it was written today by Asian writers, it would turn out very different. It was good for the 90s, but that doesn't mean it is perfect." So how would it differ today? How do you imagine if they'd...
Well, I'm very wary of saying how an Asian American writer would write Hell Money, to be fair.
Yeah. But which aspects of it do you think specifically? Because I think maybe the score would be the first one. But
well, yeah.
Which aspects do you think absolutely wouldn't fly if they'd put this in season 11, for example?
Being honest, looking at Babylon, I'm very worried that absolutely nobody would have any problems with this making it to screen.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's an unfair shot at Babylon. But I do think that if they were doing it again, probably the best thing that they could do would be to refocus the narrative around Chow. Would be to basically to make literal what's heavily implied in the way the episode shot and ended, which is that Mulder and Scully are very much on the periphery of this. So it would almost be like a Mulder and Scully light episode, where you would put Chow front and center. You probably also maybe add a relative of his who isn't involved in the game. Which would give you a sort of an outside perspective, possibly. Because, I mean, again, as he pointed out, he's third generation American Chinese. So it's quite possible that his father is, you know, sort of not involved in the community in an active way, which would allow you to sort of have that level of insulation. Outside of that, I mean, I think you get... I think a lot of it could work. I think a lot of it would just be, yeah, change the score, refocus heavily on Chow, and maybe push Mulder and Scully even more to the edge, although you'd have a lot of people argue that would not make for a better episode.
No, I mean, you can sort of imagine it being something like Hungry, though, where they use more POV shots from the, you know, from the guest character's perspective. Could be an interesting experiment in form, perhaps. Maura Function Jaeger said, "I don't recall there being any overt stereotypes portrayed, but the characters were not particularly well-rounded, so it seems the story relies a little too heavily on overly simplistic, mysterious and disturbing Chinese symbolism and supposed rituals. I don't think there was enough context or backstory provided. This episode gets points for its imagery and mood, but I've always found it a bit dull overall."
Okay.
So yeah, again, the word dull, also, you know, we've heard plodding already. Kind of a recurring
this
theme.
This is the kick Hell Money round.
Yeah.
Just to go back to what Sarah Blair was saying there, and apologise for giving her nightmares, apparently it's been estimated that up to 15% of organ transplants take place on the black market.
Is that right?
Apparently. Kosovo rebels allegedly organ trafficking in the 1990s. Stories about, like, Brazil's rumours of illegal organ trading coming from Brazil in 1987. This is a very 90s episode. This is, like, organ harvesting is a very 90s fear, I'm gathering, just looking at the statistics here. That idea, you know, that story about the person who goes on holidays and wakes up with their kidney stolen, apparently that can be traced back to 1991. So yeah, this is, Hell Money is very, very 90s.
Very 90s, without a question. Michael Little weighed in on like this debate too. He says, "I don't see how anyone could say this episode is racist. All cultures have their dark side, and the X-Files always love to explore that. The episode is also clearly on the side of the poor immigrants." And I think Clara came back to him and sort of said, there's a bit of a distinction between saying it's racist and saying it's insensitive. You know, but Michael's definitely right that the episode obviously almost goes without saying doesn't endorse the you know, the behavior of the hard-faced man and his clan. You know,
but, I mean, this is a broader, I think, discussion about when we talk about media being insensitive. And I think Clara's right to say that saying it's insensitive is not the same as saying it's racist. I think it's more that, like, and again, I absolutely love this episode. I gave this episode 9 out of 10. And I think that you can acknowledge that something's problematic or flawed or imperfect or, you know, maybe even half decent first time, but still something that wouldn't work as it does today. And still love it. Still love it to death. Still absolutely adore it, but acknowledge that in some ways it is, you know, there are aspects of it that are insensitive and aspects of it that, you know, maybe could have done with a bit more work or maybe been approached in a different way. And I think that's fair. And I think that having that discussion doesn't negate or undermine it. I think it's entirely possible to love The X-Files, and I think it's very clear that we both absolutely adore The X-Files, but and also acknowledge that sometimes it could be a little bit out, and that, you know, and that it wasn't, this isn't always a fatal flaw. Things like problematic fades exist, but also that, you know, that it's important to discuss that, or to talk about in those terms, and sort of to open our ears and sort of listen to people complaining and sort of like meet them halfway or at least hear their concerns.
Oh, totally. But it's also important for people to kind of think about the concept that you can divorce, to some extent, the problematic aspects or whatever. Like, we talked a bit about Babylon, and like, I actually quite like Babylon. I'm massively aware of, you know, the myriad of issues surrounding it.
Babylon is a punching bag, and deservedly so. But again, this is one of the things where it's like,
but
the,
it's an interesting punching bag.
It's like The Blessing Way, where I'm kind of admire the fact that it got made. I kind of admire the fact that, that Carter did that in the way that he did that. And I think that there's a host of really, really interesting ideas at work there. I also think that, yeah, there's a lot of parts of it that don't work, a lot of really, really terrible stuff that maybe could have done with like a pass, another pass over, or some feedback or some engagement with people more familiar with the workings of certain communities and certain sort of subcultures. And I think that it's entirely possible to say Babylon is a bold, ambitious piece of television that demonstrates Carter's tendency towards these sort of like abstract, lyrical, metaphorical storytelling in a way that's unlike what anybody else does in television, while also saying that it's very, very insensitive and rather unfortunate and ill-judged in terms of its content and its context. And though both of those things can be true about it.
Well, it's true. I think it's like unhinged, but it's kind of gloriously unhinged at times, and yeah, like you said, there's an interesting tension there, but like you could almost say that the same with the series as a whole at times. In terms of Hellmany, I'll give the last word to Edin Dumasic, who simply said it's quite boring. So there we go.
Touche.
Yeah, so Darren, I'm gonna spare you the indignity of the X quiz, mainly because I ran out of time to put it together.
Perfect. But, I'm heartbroken, Carl. I'm very disappointed. I feel like I'm missing out on the experience. I'm not. I'm very, very happy. I'm very glad.
So where can we find you online, or, you know, tell us a bit about your podcasts and so on. Go for it, Dan.
Oh, perfect. You can find me online writing at the Movie Blog with a 0 and 7 O in movie, but you can also just find it by Googling Darren Mooney. You can also find me online. I co-host a podcast, The 250, with my good friend Andrew Quinn, where we go through the IMDb's list of top 250 movies of all time, one movie at a time, once a week. And so we cover a whole range of stuff. Depending on when this movie's out, we may or may not be covering. I think coming up, we have off the top of my head stuff like Reservoir Dogs by Quentin Tarantino, Paper Moon by Peter Bogdanovich, which I'm very, very excited about, and even stuff like Yojimbo by Akira Kurosawa. So there's a wide range of material there, and if you have an interest in film, there should be something there for absolutely everyone in the list. I also co-host a podcast, the Scannel podcast, which looks at the week in film. It's an Irish based podcast, so we have a bunch of Irish film reviewers. We sit around, we chat about what we watched, what's happening in the world of film and television, and we also discuss the week in cinema releases, and it's good fun, and I'm very, very happy with it. So if you want to check any of those out, that'd be fantastic. And I feel really bad because I know that people have been very, very supportive, but I feel like I should mention the book I have, Opening the X-Files. I suspect everybody who's listening to this podcast is sick and tired of hearing me mention it, and I just want to say thank you very much to everybody who's supported it in any way, shape or form. It really, really means a lot to me, so thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, it's a terrific book. I'll vouch for that. So in terms of the X cast, I mean, if I know Tony Black, I suspect his disembodied voice will be along in a minute to tell you all about where you can find us on social media and about our Patreon and stuff like that.
It's not just the voices of our fathers that talk to us, Carl.
Suffice to say, though, we're in all the usual places, so please join us. Lots of discussion going on Twitter and Facebook, for example. So anyway, Darren, until the next time we get to discuss organ harvesting, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Carl. I do like a little niche.
And listeners, until next time on the X-Cast, always remember, trust no one.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/TheXcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/TheXcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.